Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 819. It's the 5th of July, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Brian McMaster, chairman of Harvest Minerals, HMI. That's a ticker there. And Brian discusses the latest results from ongoing agronomic test work at its Arapua fertilizer project in Brazil. Plus, I have Vadim Alexander, head of research at Northland Capital Partners. And Vadim discusses Immufarma, ticker there is IMM, off the back of a recent research note he's published. Also, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about Blue Rock Diamonds, BRD. It's a mineral of a company. It's around about 2.3 million market cap, but John reckons they could be heading towards a recovery here. Also on the podcast, financial analyst with Spreadex, Connor Campbell, talking about pending results from Associated British Foods, what to look out for, that's ABF ticker, and Bovis Homes, BVS. And as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs on the podcast in the last 24 hours too. By the way, the top five most followed companies in the last 24 hours are all oil and gas companies. Yeah, I can sense you're excited.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian McMaster, Executive Chairman of Harvest Minerals. Ticker there is HMI. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin.
Now, I've been watching the share price. I had a nice little bounce last few days, and I suppose it's off the back of the news you've just released, which we'll get into in a bit. But for people not aware of your company, Brian, can you explain what Harvest Minerals is all about, please?
Yeah, sure. So Harvest is a AIM-listed Brazilian fertilizer company. Brazil is one of the world's largest importers and utilizers of fertilizer, and we're one of the only, I think we are the only AIM company which has domestic production to meet Brazil's insatiable demand.
Yeah. And it seems to be going, like you said, it's a big economy out there. It's growing, and they've had their troubles of late. But it seems, like you said, they have insatiable demand, and yet also it seems like the authorities are behind this these kind of projects, are they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Brazil itself has a population of 200 million people that need to be fed, and you know, obviously it's one of the food baskets of the whole of the Americas, so demand is substantial. But as you say, the government has come out and publicly said that they want the country to develop its own fertilizer supply channels, and as a consequence, they're very supportive of companies like ours.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go into the recent bit of news, which is out a couple of days ago, and it's excellent agronomic results from the Arapua fertilizer project. So, can you take us through these results and why you believe they are excellent, and what significance they have for Harvest Minerals, please, Brian?
Sure. So, the significance of the results is simply this. The results were on a rice crop. We are using those results to make an application to be certified by the government to be what they call a remineralizer. And the certification is important in order to give everybody, all of our customers, an assurance that the product is what we say it is. So that's why we did the test, and that's what we're going to do with the results. But the results themselves tell us what we've been speculating is the case with the product for some time, and that is it's a slow-release, multi-nutrient fertilizer that, if it is applied over the course of successive seasons, ultimately it can lead to a position where it will replace traditional sources of phosphorus and potassium. And that's good news for the farmers because our product is cheaper than the current traditional sources.
Yeah, and just to give an overview of what you have here, because you're saying your initial production there of 50,000 tonnes, but also your resource is quite large, isn't it?
Yeah, the resource is very substantial. It appears at surface down to an average depth of about 25 metres. We've previously announced that we've drilled about 7% of the resource, and from that very limited drilling, we've already established a mine life of decades. So all the exploration work is done. There is no more questions about, do we have the product? What is the quality of the product? We know all of those answers. Now we're moving on to the more advanced stages of certifying the product and selling it.
Okay, and when do you hope to first start achieving some revenue from these sales, Brian?
Well, in the recent announcement, we said that we hope to achieve some sales this quarter, and that is still the aim. I think that's a realistic aim, and we expect to get the certification sometime towards the end of this year. As I say, the certification is the rubber stamp that allows us to go to all the other farmers around the region who can afford to bench test the products themselves and say, well, look, it's okay. The government said it's okay. And from there, we'd expect sales to ramp up considerably. So, it seems to us that the heavy lifting is being done. The hard work is now behind us in terms of unanswered questions, and really we're now into a market development strategy.
Okay, well, I think it's worth going through, Brian. You mentioned about ramping up sales there. It's probably worth explaining, what do you hope to ramp up to? What kind of revenue will be generated, and what kind of margin you will have on this?
Well, based on the infrastructure that we have in place at the moment and the size of the resource, we've been publicly stating that we would like to ramp up to sales of 450,000 tonnes per annum. 450,000 tonnes would generate a profit for us in round figures of about $20 million a year. So it's substantial.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'm looking right now, you're about a 13 million market cap. So that is substantial. And over what time period do you hope to do that, to achieve that? And in the short to medium term, what are you hoping to go for there?
Well, in terms of supply of the product, we're at that point already. We know the product exists. We have the roads and other infrastructure in place to go and extract it. So what we need to do is develop the customer base to start to buy the product, which the certification is obviously directly linked to that. But as we say, we're well down that path now. I mean, the grow tests, which are something that take a long time, and we've all had to wait for those results to come through, are now through. So we just have to compile the application, which we will do this month, put the application in, work through that process over the coming months, and start to develop a market.
Yeah, and you did mention there's insatiable appetite there for fertilizer in Brazil, and I suppose once you have the certification, there shouldn't be any issue finding those kind of customers, you think?
No, we've been obviously doing a lot of work behind the scenes about who the customers are and how much product that they need, et cetera, et cetera. And, within a very limited radius of our mine site, there is a substantial demand. And for us to sell 450,000 tonnes into that demand is not a huge ask, really. It's not requiring us to be a market disruptor or anything crazy. We're just simply trying to carve out a little piece of the action for harvest. And, we think that that is a realistic prospect. And based on the discussions we're having with farmers in country, everything's looking like it's heading in the right direction.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, Brian, well, listen, as you know, you've been on before. If someone's not following you right now, they're listening to this and thinking, I like the sound of this. Give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please.
Well, I think the three reasons, are consistent with the ones we talk about every time we talk, and they are that, food production and agriculture are one of the real growth engines of the world right now, and this is a really unique opportunity to participate in that spectrum. Secondly, we have a very high margin product. Our approximate sales prices run at around $60 a tonne, and our costs are less than $10, so margins are really quite massive. And thirdly, I think it's important that people understand, despite the share price going up and down a little bit, in terms of the things that the company has told the market it's going to do, we have met the market's expectations every time. So the company has set a path, it's on track with that path, and it hasn't wavered from that path. And I think that's really important.
Excellent, Brian. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, Head of Research at Northland Capital Partners. Vadim, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
But Dean, you've put out a note on ImmuPharma last Friday. So I thought we'd go over some bits and pieces about ImmuPharma. I've had the guys on the podcast previously, but people are not aware of what they're all about, Vadim. Can you give a brief summary as to what the business is all about, please?
Yeah, so basically ImmuPharma is a drug development business. They have an asset in late stages of clinical trial, which is the phase 3 trial, and the asset is called Lupizor. That's the name of the drug, and it, as the name implies, it targets the area of lupus. They have other clinical assets, but what's of main interest right now is that this clinical trial will be coming to an end soon, and it'll have a readout. It's expected in Q1 next year, which is pretty much the end stage of the long drug development journey. So there's a lot of anticipation that's being built around the completion of this trial.
Yes, so that's when, I suppose, they go into commercialization, isn't it? And what is the potential then for, Lupizor in the marketplace, do you think, Vadim?
So lupus is an interesting area because very little has been done in this space for over 50 years. The current standard of care is quite old, as you can imagine. So, people use corticosteroids, immunosuppressants, both of which have major side effects and major issues over the long term. In fact, some of the side effects are not too dissimilar to the long-term effects of lupus. So, not the greatest treatments, and yet nothing really has been invented since. There is one other drug that has been approved. It's a drug called Benlysta. It's a GlaxoSmithKline drug. And it, too, hasn't had a perfect market debut. This was launched in 2012. It also has side effects. Its efficacy isn't clean. There's a real need for something new in this space, and that's why there's a major unmet medical need. I mentioned Benlysta. Even though it isn't the best drug, because of this need, it's already selling to the tune of $400 million per year. So, there is a real market for novel lupus drugs, and that's exactly what Lupizor hopes to be. And again, the timelines are short now. We're at the end of the clinical trial journey, and once this readout occurs, we hope to see something develop in terms of commercial licensing deal or something of that ilk.
Yeah, okay. And as far as the rights is concerned, is it still the case that ImmuPharma own 100% of it?
Basically what happened is that the history is quite interesting. They've already actually struck a commercial deal with a company called Cephalon. This is in 2008, 2009. And then Cephalon itself, which this is a mid-tier pharmaceutical company, they received about $40 million worth of payments from Cephalon for the development of the drug. This is when it was a phase 2 asset. What happened to Cephalon is it itself was acquired by a company called Teva, which is a generics drug manufacturer, and it just dropped to the bottom of the priority list for Teva, and they weren't interested in further developing it. And as part of the contract with ImmuPharma, they had to return all the rights back to ImmuPharma. So ImmuPharma got $40 million worth of milestone and upfront payments, and now have all the rights returned back to them. So they continued developing the drug, and now we're at phase 3, and we're waiting for the readout on that.
And when do you think this readout will come? How far away is it in time frame-wise?
Yeah, so it's Q1 2018, so sometime early next year. So it's about, at the latest, 9 months away.
Okay, excellent. And I see you've raised your price target on the thing at the moment. What is your current price target here?
Yeah, so it's 181p, which is more than a 3x uplift because the current share price is about 54p on screen, and I guess that's the main point. We raised the raise was a marginal raise on the target price, but we always were kind of a big believer in and had a bullish view of the company. I think the bigger point though is that the target price itself is minor compared to where this drug could go if it did get approved or get a licensing deal. In that we're talking about I mentioned Benlysta earlier on. In terms of its market potential right now, it's selling $400 million per year in sales. So we're looking at billion-dollar drugs potentially. Benlysta, actually, just to give you a valuation marker that's out there, it was co-developed between GlaxoSmithKline and a company called Human Genome Sciences. When they got their data readouts, GlaxoSmithKline bought the other half. So it was 50-50 owned, and GSK bought Human Genome Sciences mm-hmm. out of its 50% stake for $3.6 billion. You know, so we're total value of Benlysta, at the time of phase three readout was about $7 billion in 2012, I think, or 2011, 2012. So that gives you a hint of what, you know, my target price is a 3x uplift, but all of this is still minor. If this ever gets to market or to a licensing deal, we're not talking about 181p. We're talking about a substantial uplift on even my target price.
I understand. And at the moment, ImiPharma is around about 73 million in market cap, so you can see the potential here, upside. So, okay, excellent stuff.
Exactly. Just a quick one on that. Even a licensing deal would involve an upfront payment probably larger than the market cap of the business.
Wow. Okay. So if people are looking at this now, they like the sound of what you're saying, Vidim, but they're not following ImiPharma on Vox Markets. Give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, on ImiPharma's page.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, we've touched on a few of them, but I'll reiterate some of the points. So yes. Lupus is a major unmet medical need. So there's a real need for new drugs in this space. Benlysta is a testament to that. You know, it has an established path to market because of Benlysta. So the funny thing is, we have one drug that's recently approved. We know what the market metrics are like and what a new drug could follow in, you know, it could follow in Benlysta's footsteps, is what I mean. So there, we know that there's a market for new drugs. It's now well established because of Benlysta. And then finally, you know, another thing we didn't touch on, but Lupazor has a really strong regulatory pathway. Basically, they've been the FDA has given them a couple of things, which I won't get into the detail of which, but he's given them a fast track and another thing called an SPA. And that basically, what it says is that the FDA looks favorably upon Lupazor and it recognizes at some level that there is a real market need for new drugs. And, you know, the potential for a new lupus drug is really, it's clear. You know, if it works, and if it works even remotely better than Benlysta, then we have a big drug, it'll be a big drug on the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Vidim, thanks very much for coming on. Much appreciated. And hopefully we'll speak again very soon. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. John, I sent you outdoors, al fresco.
Yes, yeah, I'm just outside in Hanover Square, overlooking a fabulous Crossrail project. Good example of British industry at its very best.
And I highly recommend people get on the BBC iPlayer there and look at the documentary on that. Because in the mornings I get up, I do a bit on the treadmill, and I got my phone there and I watch that. And I watched about the fourth episode. It's called The 15 Billion Pound Railway. And it is phenomenal. The accuracy as to which the size of this project underground, pretty much, which they're building. But listen, they have to be spot on to the millimeter on everything they do, pretty much. And it's amazing, like you said, British engineering at its best, you know. And I would advise anyone to catch up on that. It's an amazing documentary. Anyway, we're not here to chat about catch up TV. We talk about stocks. So what are you looking at, John? What's on your radar this week?
Well, we had news this morning from Blue Rock Diamonds, mm-hmm. ticker is BRD, mm-hmm. And they've had a difficult couple of years. They've been mining through what's called calcrete, which is sort of nature's version of concrete, for a while, and they've been getting great diamonds out of it, but the grades have been poor and the rock has been really hard. Now that they're really through that and they're going into the softer kimberlite, the grade should probably treble. Hopefully, according to the estimates, and we're hoping that the quality of the diamonds coming out will remain at least the same. No reason why that shouldn't happen, but we don't absolutely know, because the last stone recovered was a nice 11 carat diamond. Not sure what the value of that is, but the value of diamonds recovered in the last parcel was, I think, $355 a carat, which is a good value. And if ahead of our expectations. So if now that they're through this calcatrized layer, they hit these grades of four and a half carats per 100 tons, and the values stay at $350 a carat, then this stock should be off to the races.
Yeah, I know nothing about this company, and I vaguely heard of them, but I've never looked into them. And they are a minnow at 2.2 million market cap. You think it's they've had a hard time, which hopefully is turning the corner, you reckon, yeah?
Yeah, they've been so far under the radar, they're not even on it. Mm. There are times to talk about stocks and times not to. And it wasn't a good idea to promote this company when things were not going well, when they were trying to sort out production issues, and when the machinery just wasn't doing the job it was supposed to do. Now the new CEO seems to have got things together. He seems to be hitting the production targets, and the diamonds are coming out, and the diamonds are bigger and better than anyone had expected, which is what we're really looking for.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Your sentiment is echoed by Adam Waugh, the chief executive, who says, "We are encouraged by the recent increase in production, which strengthens our confidence that our plant is capable of operating consistently at targeted volumes." And he also says that sales per carat achieved for our production continues to be above CPR expectations. And as we move deeper ground, we expect grades to improve and the cash flow positive in the near term. So, it's looking... He seems quite bullish, isn't he?
Well, I think... I don't want to call that understatement, but I think that is a very measured comment that he's made. And the numbers... Going through the numbers, for me, verifies what he says. The production targets seem to be there. The diamond values seem to be there. What we need confidence now in is will the grades increase in the softer underlying kimberlite, and will the diamond values remain at these high levels? And hopefully they will, but we don't know until we get there. So we're hopeful, and we are looking forward to better results going forwards.
Marvellous. Thanks for putting that on our radar there, John. That's Blue Rock Diamonds. Do your own research. This is just information, not investment advice. But BRD is a ticker. John, are you staying out there for a sunbathe there? I imagine you on a towel in Bermuda shorts.
No, I'm going straight back to the office. I've just had a meeting with Greg Hands in relation to a new initiative promoting British industry exporting into other parts of the world.
Well, listen, you deserve a lay down after that. Get the shorts out. Cheers, John. Speak next week.
Fantastic. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast right now is Connor Campbell, financial analyst at Spreadex. You're right, Connor?
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Lovely stuff. And are you into Wimbledon?
I'll keep up with it, and if I'm bored on a Saturday or Sunday, I'll stick it on, but not...
Yeah, that's a no. That's a no then, really. Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't got into it, but I did hear today, apparently, 7 people went out injured in the first round. Now, you'd think...
Yeah, I was reading that, yeah.
Yeah, and they said there's a reason for this, because if you play, apparently, you get, like, 45 grand even. Even if you play the first round, £45,000. So,
oh, really? Oh, people going in... injured, yes. Knowing they get a payday.
Yeah, and people at the lower end. Of course, the big guys, the top sort of 10 seeds, they don't need the money anyway, or top 20 seeds or whatever, don't need the money. But the guys struggling to make a living, like some of them, I think it was one British player, they said he's about, a couple of grand in debt. I mean, even if you're injured, you would play a game, wouldn't you, just to get that 45 grand? Because that's above the average wage for a year just for playing one game of tennis.
Yeah, that's a big old, chunk of money for appearing in the first round. I didn't realize it was
exactly. I don't care if I had a plaster on my leg. If my leg was falling off, I'd drag myself onto the court just to hit one ball. So, yeah, thanks, 45 grand in the bank. Cheers. But they're looking at changing this now, because apparently there's other tours. Apparently, if you make it to the cut, you get paid anyway. But then if you get injured, then you still get paid. So, they're saying there's this loophole there that people, injured players will do all they can to try and get, their first game there and then get the money. Anyway, let's move on to onto stocks, onto companies. So, who are releasing this week, Connor? What's the news?
Well, we've got probably the biggest company left to report this week is Associated British Homes, which obviously owns Primark.
Associated British Foods. I know where you're going with this.
British Foods.
Do you know what? The reason why you said that is I know what stock you're talking about next, and you've amalgamated them together almost. It's almost Associated British Foods.
A mega company.
Yeah, they've bought Bovis Homes. Associated British Homes. So Associated British Foods, yes, they own Primark, and for a while... I don't know about recently, but Primark was the flagship, wasn't it? There, really doing well. But I don't know what the other parts of the business. How are they doing?
Well, it's interesting, you know, like you're saying, Primark traditionally, or at least in the last few years, has been the highlight for Associated British Foods. Even if other areas of the business weren't doing too well, investor focus tended to be on Primark and how it was doing. To the extent that at the start of the year, when Associated British Foods didn't release like-for-like sales figures for Primark, even though sales had jumped 12%, it was seen as a negative because that's how hungry, I guess, investors are for info about the company, and they want to make sure that it's growing, not just because it's got a mega store on every, you know, high street in the country, but that people are returning to the, you know, returning to the brand year on year. However, this year, you know, we've seen, you know, well-publicised struggles of the retail sector in the last few months, especially with increasing inflation and falling wages and things like that. Primark has begun to take a hit, really. I think in its half-year figures earlier in the year, on a constant currency basis, pre-tax profit actually fell 2% at the company. Now, compare that to its sugar division, which has tended to be, you know, not the best side of things. Pre-tax profit jumped from 3 million to 123 million year on year, which is huge. And that's partly to do with rising sugar prices, partly to do with the weakened pound. But you can see that really carried Associated British Homes, you know, through its half year, and it caused, in the end, profits were still up 35% and revenue was still up 19%. But there was still there was a marked difference between the sugar division and Primark that perhaps was the other way round for the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I suppose when you are a leader like Primark, because the clothes were so cheap there, you know, other competitors in that space were struggling against them, weren't they? And so you have to change your game. You know, you have to start competing or check out of the business. And so I think when it started, for years and years and years, it had no real competition at the price points they were selling stuff at. But then I think the industry sort of, you know, took on the challenge, and now it's probably finding it hard and finding a lot more competition out there, aren't they, really?
Yeah, and there's also, it's got, you know, like you're saying, clothes are so cheap at Prime, and obviously they're made fairly cheaply. That's what allows them to have that price point. But it is going to come under increased margin pressure in the second half of the year. Already as well, Associated British Homes has said that where weakened sterling was a boost in the first half of the year, it's going to increasingly become a burden in the second half of the year. So I think that's what investors are going to be on the lookout for tomorrow. It's its third quarter report. I think investors are really going to know, okay, well, how much has inflation been eating into its margins? How much has inflation been eating into its sales as people have less money to spend? Again, Primark's price point perhaps protects it somewhat compared to, say, like Next and M&S, a bit more expensive. If people are going to start, you know, if people do need clothes and their wallets are a bit pinched, maybe they will go to Primark. So it has that slight layer of protection compared to some of its other rivals. But I still think it's going to, you know, be difficult for the store in the second half of the year, especially if its margins are constantly eaten into by, you know, if the pound gets any weaker and it hasn't now got that currency hedge that seems to have been eroded in the last few months.
Yeah. Well, they sell rubbish, don't they, let's be honest. People will go there, and I bought T-shirts from there before, buy five to, and I know, I don't care. If you're going somewhere, like a camping or something, and you suspect you may get muddy or you've got a festival, you can go there, just stock up on clothes and chuck them in the bin afterwards. You don't care, you know, because it's that cheap. So they're definitely not going for quality, but maybe they need to up that quality there. Okay, let's move on then to, what's the next one? Bovis Homes.
It sort of bungled its way to 12-month highs, basically.
Really?
You know, it's now its best price since Brexit last year. And that's despite, you know, not a lot of good news, really. You know, at the end of 2016, between Boxing Day and New Year's Eve, it released a profit warning, which I guess they were trying to get news out when perhaps there weren't as many eyes on it. Then at the start of the year, its full-year figures in February, it revealed that it was having to pay out $7 million to repair homes that it had, you know, that home buyers had moved into, but they were in disrepair already. And I think that followed on from a scandal where it was claimed Bovis was basically bribing home buyers with like $3,000 or something to move into incomplete homes so they could meet sales targets. So that caused a huge plunge in February. Yet then there was all the sort of M&A rumours and the proposals from Redrow and Galliford Try, and that sort of rescued the stock from its mid-February lows. And even though those you know, those proposals didn't come to anything. Bovis repeatedly rebuffed both companies. It did lead to a new CEO in Greg Fitzgerald, who was formerly of Galliford Try. And since then, that sort of really helped the stock out. And there's been a few bits of news since then to help it out. I think it said it was cutting production by 10%, which I think has eased investors' fears that it could, you know, have these sort of sales target issues that cause some sort of less than savoury behaviour. Then it also, Fitzgerald, like the new CEO, bought £2 million worth of shares, which, even if it's just a tokenistic sign of confidence, that did help it keep the stock at those 12-month highs. It's, you know, around the 950 mark, where, you know, at the start of the year, it was looking pretty ropey.
Yeah. I was surprised when you said that. I haven't been keeping a check on, I'm more in the lower end of the market cap spectrum, but I mean, I haven't been keeping an eye on that. But when you said it's towards 12-month highs, really? After all the trouble they've had and the controversy and the headlines? Surprising. So,
it seems investors are giving it the benefit of the, since the new CEO took over, investors have been giving it the benefit of the doubt somewhat. Thursday's update will be the first from the new CEO, and I think they've got an actual, a proper sort of turnaround plan / strategy review thing pinched in for September. So tomorrow's report might be a bit light on detail, but it will, you know, it gives investors a chance to feel out the new CEO, see what kind of direction he's going to take Bovis in, and gives the company a chance to gauge, okay, well, how much wiggle room are investors going to give us before we need to, you know, actually produce the goods and keep it, you know, to keep it at the current levels.
Yeah. Okay, marvellous stuff. Connor, thanks for that. Have a nice week. Speak next weekend. Not next weekend, sorry. I was thinking about you watching Wimbledon on the weekend there. If you get bored, tune into Wimbledon. It's always there. That's the thing, isn't it? If you do get bored, it's always there on the TV. That's the next couple of weeks. So speak next week, fella. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Providence Resources. That's PVR ticker. At three, it is 88 Energy. That's ATD. They're all oil and gas companies, by the way. At three, Canadian Overseas Petroleum. Copple. Did I say 88 Energy is at three? Sorry, 88 Energy is four, obviously. At two, Angus Energy, ANGS. And number one most followed company. They're linked. They have joint interest in assets in the Weald Basin. It's UK Oil and Gas, UKOG. Snoop Dogg. I don't know what I'm talking about here. Top five most liked RNSs on the Vox Markets platform in the last 24 hours were, at five, Edenville Energy, EDL, Tanzanian legislative changes. At four, Echo Energy, Q3 portfolio update. At three, also Echo Energy, it's a board appointment. At two, Sound Energy, update Sidi Mokhtar. And number one most liked RNS on Vox Markets platform this morning was from SDX Energy, and they did an operations update. Don't know why it's gone down in that, though. Very odd, it's gone down, but there we are. Who knows why? It was quite liked. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.